Honestly, I think you could put 100 GMs in my position. 3 or 4 of them do as good as I did. The Nuggets experience to me is this. It's the gift and the curse of Jokic. When Jokic is in your universe, everybody takes everything else for granted. Coach Malone, he doesn't deserve to be commentating games over some perceived rift when somebody's running a team. I don't think the expectation is the bad 1,000. For some reason, I started to get the feeling that that was the expectation for me.
Joining me today, Calvin Booth. How are you doing, Calvin?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great as well, man. It's good to have you. Just to be clear, we are on the record.
Record set. Oh, you're going to start off like that?
I had to make the joke.
That's pretty good.
The quote that sticks to me from our first time meeting back in 2023, it's kind of a big picture thought. It's just always been on my mind ever since then. Overlap is a silent killer. And that line, every time I watch teams, I think about that team building. When did that realization occur to you during your playing career or your executive career, the importance of avoiding overlap? And can you describe what you meant by that?
My thought process about basketball doesn't stop. It's always, I mean, I'm sure you're the same way. Anybody that truly has a passion for it, truly loves it, is always talking about it, always integrating different things into their thoughts. And I think my basketball knowledge and acumen, philosophy is just an aggregation of all the conversations I've had as a player, being coached, conversations with friends, conversations with colleagues. So I think it came along during that process.
And so what was like some instances that made it kind of develop over time?
I just think there's things that just stand out, right? Like, you know, there was a term introduced to me, early in my tenure at Denver as the general manager, and it was called basketball character. See, me at that time, I'd have looked at character as like one catch-all, but basketball character is different than off the court character. Like Dennis Rodman's probably one of the best examples of all time. Like, you know, obviously he had some wild times and go to Vegas and do his thing.
The wedding dress, right?
Yeah. But I mean, from a basketball character standpoint, maybe the best basketball character of all time, unselfish, played hard, tough, like teammates loved him. I mean, I think that's what gave him the latitude to be able to leave the team and go to Vegas. Like, that's why those guys were okay with that when that happened, you know?
He's just true to himself. And like he's just fully true to himself off the court. And then on the court, I guess in some ways, maybe that manifested for him in terms of like, I'm just going to go all out and do what I want to do.
Yeah, I think there's certain qualities that I think that's where you have to toe the line. That, like, every team wants toughness, but what does that look like when it's a little unrestrained? Like maybe like a Jimmy Butler or something like that, right?
Well,
but
some
like,
of those guys have screws loose, right? Yeah, that's part of what makes them tick.
Yeah, exactly. But those are, Dylan Brooks is the best example this year. He's having a fantastic year. He along with, I believe, Colin Gillespie have changed the culture of that team. I think Colin's gotten more of a role. He's a guy we're familiar with in Denver who's ultra, ultra competitive. And I think, you know, Dylan going in there and being who he is kind of like helped spur that change. And obviously, Jordan Knott's done a fantastic job.
As an executive, and particularly as a GM, the guy making the final decision on drafting players or trading for players, how do you assess basketball character versus like the off-court character you're talking about? How do you differentiate those two things? And is it intel? Is it interviewing? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, I think basketball character, you can probably watch a game and see a guy diving on the floor, seeing him setting hard screens, not caring about not getting the ball, being engaged in a game, all those different things. And then I think the off-the-court stuff, you know, a lot of times who somebody is on the court is probably who they're going to be off the court, but you have to fact-check that. So that's where the calls and the intel and talking to people you know really becomes important.
One of the things that's been on my mind a lot this season is with size, smaller guards. And that's particularly been in my mind because of the nature of the 2026 draft class. There's a lot of smaller guards, Kingston Flemings or Bennett Sturts, Anderson. There's a bunch of them in this year's class. One of the things that you and I talked about back in 2023 was about how you did a study when you were first hired as GM of the Nuggets, where you looked at all the champions since 08. And I remember you said that the Miami Heat, I think it was the 2013 Miami Heat, were the only team that didn't have an average height of, you know, 6'10", or it was average wingspan of 6'11", and average weight of at least 235 pounds or something like that when you removed the smallest player. I think you had a study done about the size and length of those championship teams, aside from the smallest player. Is that an accurate description of that study you guys did?
Well, there's a lot of things went on there. Well, first of all, hey, Bennett, Christian Anderson, King Snack at your back. You're not small.
Yeah.
What are you looking for, Magic Johnson?
Jesus, I mean, we get a lot of, sure, fine.
Man, those guys aren't small. Like, fine.
Last year, Jace Richardson, is
Tyler,
he small?
Tyler Tanner's small. And he's a fantastic player. And I think it just ties into the concept that I talked about before. Like, I just think the requirements or the restrictions, if you want to have multiple, I think, you know,
so you can have one.
Ty Lue is probably the best example in the Lakers teams. Like, he was that change of pace. He came off the bench. He guarded AI. Like, depending on what conference you're in, depending on who your peers are, you're probably going to need one player like that. And I think in the modern era, Patty Mills has been like the guy that I would use as an archetype. Like, if my one small guy, I want to be like Patty Mills. I want him to be fast. I want him to be able to shoot. I want him to be able to take the care of the ball. Like, basically have a completely polished game, which is very hard when you first come out of college. So I think that's probably the biggest issue as far as like in the premium portion of the draft, drafting somebody. Like, are they going to be able to become polished enough? Like, Braden Smith and Tyler Tanner and some of these guys are extremely polished for college, right? But there's going to be like a little bit of a learning curve when they get to the NBA.
Well, like, you see that with Reed Sheppard, Rob Dillingham, guys like that, right?
Yeah, so for sure.
And I think when it comes to those smaller guards, that's the thing. Like, I loved Reed Sheppard in the draft. I had him ranked number one that year, and that might end up being a mistake. It could be Stephon Castle who ends up the best player in that draft class. I think Alex Saar, you were high on him, so it could be somebody else. But it's just so tough for smaller guards in the NBA today, the way they're attacked relentlessly defensively in the playoffs, even shot creation aspect when so many other teams are big and long across positions, being able to generate quality shot opportunities. So your thought is that, like, you can have one of those guys, but you can't have too many.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's just trying not to be the exception to the rule. That's the whole concept. Like, I think, as proven, Trae Young, when the team's built right around him, he made his team to the conference finals, and maybe like he could be the exception to the rule and lead a team to a championship. It just hasn't happened very much.
Now, with you in 2022, your first year drafting, you took Christian Brown, your first pick, traded for Peyton Watson, the aggressive trade to draft him, Will Barton for KCP, you signed Bruce Brown, traded Bones Highland to create minutes for Brown. You guys went 16-4, win the championship. Did you expect that much dominance from that team on their playoff run?
I think we had the talent. I think there was a game in Philly that we actually lost. I was like, man, I was saying to myself and to people around that we might be able to win it, but during that game in the first half, we ended up losing the game ultimately. And when Embiid shot like an 80-foot shot and they gave him 3 free throws, when Joker's done that like 10 times, they never get on free throws. But anyway, I digress. We lose that game, but there was portions of that game where we really looked like we were humming and that we could maybe do some big stuff in the playoffs, and those guys came together. And there's several things you could say about, in particular, the players with the Nuggets. The Joker, Jamal, Aaron, Michael Porter Jr., all those guys on down, KCP, all those guys, Christian, they think they can beat anybody. And it sounds like that's like not that big of a deal, but I've been on a variety of teams and some have had great players. And I don't necessarily think every time you go into a game, even if you have a really good player, that even the guys at the top of roster feel like they're supposed to beat the San Antonio Spurs or whatever. Like, but every time those guys enter a game, they feel like they're supposed to win and they're never intimidated by the moment. You know, they show up big in the clutch. Like, you know, Joker, there's no limit to his ceiling over long durations. And Jamal has the same thing in spurts, right? So,
was there a moment, a specific moment or a game during that title run where you're like, we're going to win it all. We're going to win this. It's going to happen.
I just think it's more feeling like the pressure that, you know, you should win it because Miami, they made it there and you had to give them credit, but they're a playing team, you know? So like, you know, if you don't close, if you don't win it, that might be the only opportunity.
What did you see from Bruce Brown and his past stops, Brooklyn and Detroit, to make you feel like he could be a good fit in Denver?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it was a collaborative effort. I think like, you know, from the front office to Coach Malone, like everybody saw, but I, you know, so Donovan Mitchell, I think, was a drop before him. So the next year, he's playing point guard at Miami. He ends up getting hurt, drops to the second round. And then, you know, he plays some point guard at Detroit. All of a sudden, they have him playing like a wildcat position with Brooklyn. He's basically playing the four and he's short roll and he's doing these unique things, but you know, he has a history of being able to play the point guard, right? So, I think that was a final thing to me that really pushed it over the top.
The versatility aspect, like the ability to fill different spaces.
And knowing that, like, going back to your thing about being big, that we were, if playing our most optimized lineup, we could play him at the backup point guard, you know?
And he had size.
Yeah. He plays bigger than what he is. He was playing the four in Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, like, I love watching him set screens and play, operate out of the short roll. He was fun to watch for the Nets. So like when you guys got him, I was like, oh my God, they're going to use him as a screener for Jokic. He's going to be involved in two-man actions. It's going to be beautiful. And it was, I think, even better than anybody could have anticipated. Yeah, I think that's why Denver got him back, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Such good chemistry with Jokic. What's your best Jokic story?
I mean, there's so many Jokic stories. I think the general theme is just, I think I'm amused at how he's kind of like, for lack of better word, kind of like tricked everybody into thinking that he doesn't like basketball that much. Like, you know, I don't think it's intentional. I don't think it's like he goes out there to do it, but like just his whole attitude and everything. And then you ask him about a random EuroLeague game. He's like, oh yeah, I watched it. You know, or like what happened last night. I think the guy's always watching basketball. I think he's obsessed with it. He's obviously obsessed with his family, and he really likes horses. I think family first. I think basketball second, regardless of what he would say.
Even about horse racing.
Yeah, of course.
You're dispelling the myth.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think he really loves horses. Yeah. And I think it's a welcome respite for the pressure cooker he's in during the season. But like, if you remove the pressure, he just got to go out and play basketball with his friends or on a lower level team, I think he would enjoy that experience as much or more than he would owning horses.
I think with Jokic, the way I've always thought about it is, even if you do say he doesn't quote unquote love basketball, he definitely loves competition.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
With him, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's the nature of the beast with all the guys that play in NBA. All of them are super competitive. The best ones just end up being able to express that competitiveness to the best.
Yes. You were hired in Denver in 2017, right? I'm pretty sure as an assistant, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So that was the beginning of Jokic's third year. What did you see from Jokic with his growth on defense from that time to what he became closer to his peak?
I think it was just a commitment to his fitness and conditioning because everybody's going to always try to put him in screen and roll. I think like the more the stakes were raised for the team, I think, you know, just a little bit more effort being able to put into it. And, you know, he knows that he has to be a plus, close to a plus defensively for them to win. And so I think he brings that to the table. But like he just get more reps in the pick and roll, knowing where he's more comfortable at. I think there was a realization at some point that he knew he needed to impact the ball to be the best because that's when he could use his hands and his feet and smarts to like disrupt the play. If he's sitting back in a drop, you know, it's kind of a sitting duck.
If you're working with a player like that, so with Jokic, it seemed like with him, it was more just conditioning. Like he needed his body to catch up with his mind. With some players, it's the opposite problem. Like with Anthony Edwards, he's an unbelievable athlete, 99th percentile athlete, but off ball, there's so many times where he just loses focus. Guys cut behind him. He leaves open shooters. How would you work with a guy like an Anthony Edwards type where he has the athleticism and you know what he has it in him, but it's not there consistently.
I think it's just time. My thing is, when you come into the league, you're going to be able to do one thing consistently well. Now somebody's going to say, like, well, what about VJ Edgecombe? I haven't watched every Philadelphia game, but I venture to say his two-way play probably goes flashes in and out because he's trying to do both and he's capable of doing both at times. Like, there's probably inconsistency to it. If he were just to focus on defense, he could probably be one of the best defenders this year, right? But he's obviously has some offensive talent. And conversely, if he was like, you know what, I'm be Anthony Edwards, I'm just focused on scoring, he could probably average 20. But I think in general, you're only going to be able to do one thing well when you come into the league consistently.
What were conversations like with Jokic to try to get him to get into optimal shape?
I think he's a self-motivated guy. I think you have to talk to Felipe Eichenberger about that more than me. Like, him and Felipe have a different relationship, and they really trust each other. And there's times when, you know, Felipe will get on about something way back when, maybe he's drinking a Coke or something like that. And maybe that day Jokic doesn't want to hear it, and he, like, argues back with him. I'll drink whatever I want. You know, it's and so, like, they go back and forth. But I give Felipe a lion's share. And obviously, the drive has to come from without Joker. So ultimately, he gets the credit. But, like, Felipe is the only one he's going to listen to on that kind of stuff.
You mentioned thing that made me think about Michael Finley taking the beer from Luka.
Yeah. I think a little different scenario.
Much different scenario, that's for sure. What was your reaction when that trade happened, the Luka trade happened?
I think, like, everybody was surprised.
Yeah, no hints, nothing that could be happening.
I don't think many people did. I think if, you know, I heard Shams recalling of it, he seemed like he was even shocked to hear it, so.
Yeah, I think we all were. I was laying in bed when that happened. I was like, there's no way this is real, but it was. Post-title, KCP goes, Bruce Brown goes. Were those guys harder to replace than maybe expected?
You just have certain mandates from an organization, right? I think we tried our best to keep, especially Bruce. I think in fairness to KCP, was there an all-out effort to pursue him and like offer him what he wanted right away? There absolutely was not. By the time we got the deal and it came back to us, we definitely tried to do our best to see if we could keep him. But I mean, I've been on the other side of that before. He probably felt disrespected and all that kind of stuff and didn't even consider that an offer. So, like, there's been stuff out there where he didn't get offered. But, like, you know, we definitely were willing, especially for what he was going to take from Dallas to try to match it. But I think what Orlando ended up giving him with no state tax is just too hard to beat.
You mentioned no state tax. That's a consideration for these players when it comes to contract offers that are out there for them.
No, for sure.
Is that hard to deal with? Is that part of, like, negotiations with agents when it comes to, like, well, we're offering this dollar amount, you guys are offering that dollar amount? Because it feels like publicly not a lot of people talk about it. But within the league, is that a constant conversation with negotiations?
Well, hey, look, this is a very interesting question you bring up because you say KCP and Bruce, and those guys were huge losses. I think one of the tipping points or things where it went the other way, as far as, like, perception of how the roster was being built and all that stuff was like Jeff Green, right? And Jason Glushon, a fantastic agent, did a great job for him. And, you know, they wanted a two-year guarantee. With the rules, I can't remember the term right now. I've been out for too long. But basically, if you give them a second year, that basically meant we would have to pay like a $6 million tax to do that. And we're like, we can't do the second year. And I remember the conversation like yesterday. It's like, are you going to make me go get it? And he called back and he had like an $8 million a year offer from Houston. And obviously we weren't going to be able to match that. But like it would never even gotten to that if, you know, we would have just given him a two-year contract and paid the $4 or $5 million tax. I mean, I don't think any president of basketball operations or general manager, though, in their right mind would ask their owner to spend just $5 million extra dollars to for an extra year of a contract when all we had to do was play that out. And, you know, we thought Jeff was still going to be good and just sign him to another 1 year, right? So,
I mean, I think, you know, like those guys are obviously hard losses, but ultimately it's like Peyton Watson was the guy who kind of replaced those Bruce Brown minutes. And Peyton Watson has turned into a rising star this year. I mean, Peyton Watson looks like a potential all-star, all-NBA caliber talent. Yeah. Obviously, this is now the year 2026. That was 23-24 season, but Peyton Watson has turned into something special. I mean, he's probably one of the late first-round picks we've had in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, I think in most situations when somebody's running a team, I don't think the expectation is to bat 1,000. For some reason, I started to get the feeling that that was the expectation for me. From whoever was in around the Denver Nuggets community or whatever, right? And I look at it like this even now, you know, I don't pay attention much to all the social media and stuff and aspects like that. But sometimes I am amused by some of the things I see or hear. And I'm just like, I think about it like this. All right, so you have a headache, right? You want to take a Tylenol to get rid of the headache, but it makes you drowsy. Do you want to get rid of the headache or not get rid of the headache? Because if you want to get rid of the headache, you have to take the whole pill. So you cannot separate Peyton Watson and Christian Brown from some of the other things that the people weren't happy with, right?
Sure.
You know, like you have to take, I guess you can, and they have, distill it down to that in their own non-reality world. But the reality of the thing is that, like, if we sign Bruce Brown back, we sign KCP back, or if they leave and we sign veterans, you know, we bring Torrey Craig back. He's been out there. We were after Torrey Craig. Do Christian Brown and Peyton Watson do what they're doing right now?
Maybe not.
Probably not.
They might definitely get lost
not.
In the shuffle.
Definitely not.
Right?
Definitely not. They're not going to play.
Yeah. They might have been guys that end up getting traded and they become good players on their second team.
You need minutes to develop, right? And, so I think that's, I mean, you can get in the weeds and talk about different scenarios with the Nuggets, but I think it boils down to this. The Nuggets experience to me is this, right? Well, I really think about it. I think I saw Michael Porter Jr. talking about this the other day. It's the gift and the curse of Jokic, right? Like, and I embrace that, but like when Jokic is in your universe, everybody takes everything else for granted, right? Oh yeah, it's just because they have Jokic. But I actually think it's the opposite. When I look at the Chicago Bulls, the Spurs, the teams that won multiples, like everybody does their job the best. Like you could have argued in those scenarios that best president, best coach, best star, best six role player, best six man. They had all that stuff covered, right? So, I mean, but it's par for the course. I think the second thing is, like, in my situation, thinking about this, I've had some time to think about it. There's such a weird paradox with NBA coaches, right? They're in the midst of the lion den. They're dealing with players. They're some of the most formidable size-wise and ego-wise in the world. And they're managing them, they're coaching them, those guys buy in. And then, I don't think there's anywhere else in the world where this happens. They have to, quote-unquote, report to, like, a general manager, maybe doesn't have the gravitas they do. You know, I just think it's a human nature thing. I just think it's really hard. So you put that into our scenario and all the stuff that was floating out there. You know, you take a coach that's tenured as long as Michael Malone, has accomplished what he's done, has won a championship. And, like, I never even tried to position myself like he was reporting to me. But, like I think that's where the perceived friction comes from, right? I don't even think it's, like, you know, I don't think it's that personal. When I look back on it, I don't think it's that personal. I think that could happen with a lot of coaches in the same situation. And, honestly, I think you could put 100 GMs in my position. I don't know what, 3 or 4 of them do as good as I did and handle the situation as well as I did. You know, right? So that's the way I look at it.
Was there friction during the title run, or did it happen after that?
No, I mean, I think you know, it's been talked about. When you win, everybody sees themselves in the photo, and everybody, you know, I won't take myself out of that. I think the ego stuff get involved. So that's the second paradox. I think the third thing is, when you talk about my overall situation, why I'm here without a job, I think you have to talk about, like, different ownership groups and how they operate and the choice they decide to make. And the ownership group there with Josh and Stan, they've been on record by saying, I think this is one of the most underrated aspects of my scenario, one of the reasons why I might not be employed right now, above and beyond this whole, you know, lack of alignment or whatever you want to call it. But whether it's Mark Workington or Tim or Masai, there's always going to come to a point where they don't value executives like that. They don't think they should make too much. And so they just make an option to go in another direction, right? And they got two other young, good guys, and Ben and John, they have bright upside, but I think that would have had to be part of the equation in my scenario. And the last thing is, I think I just made it a little too easy.
What do you mean by that, a little too easy?
All right, so you're a podcaster, journalist. Anybody that has that's really good at something, when they make it look easy, that was really, really hard to get to. Like I said at the beginning of the conversation, so a lifetime's worth of playing basketball, being coaching basketball, having conversations, scouting, doing whatever. For me to make it like, go in there right away, assemble a championship team, win a championship. And that's the part that, like, I'll separate that for a second. I'll finish with the last and final thing. I think when you take the Joker thing, the head coach paradox, the ownership and their presence, and hey, look, they have a formula that works. Championships in hockey, basketball, football. Arsenal will probably get one soon. So, I mean, and it's their prerogative to operate that way. And I think it's the right call. I would probably disagree with their take upon executives, especially in this world, but like, who am I? They've been so successful, right? Like, so maybe it's the right way to operate. But I'll say that you encompass that, all that, in some media manipulation. And then all of a sudden, somehow, some way, I'm not running an NBA team right now.
And we'll be right back after this break. I mean, I think, you mentioned the success aspects in 2022, Christian Brown and Peyton Watson. 2023, Jalen Pickett, Julian Strother, Hunter Tyson, Colin Gillespie on a two-way. Gillespie's going to become a key starter on one of the biggest surprises of the NBA in the Suns this year. Pickett, key rotation guy. Strother's looked better. 2024, De'Ron Holmes, Achilles injury. I mean, it's hard to judge that. But Spencer Jones on a two-way as well. Like, you could add, a couple things I noticed. There are no small guards, a lot of upperclassmen, and a lot of successes in the 3 years that you drafted for Denver. When you what goes on through your head when you see Watson being a rising star, Christian Brown looking good, Pickett being a rotation guy, the two-way successes with Gillespie and Jones, what goes on through your head when you think about that that hit rate?
Yeah, again, so I think you have to understand the foundation of these things, right? Like, I think first and foremost, I enjoyed doing that job because I like problem solving. I like building, right? And understanding that situation and that team you're with, like, I feel like if you come up with a plan and address something early enough, you usually have two good options, right? I know from my experience in that building that one of them is probably not having an $80 million tax bill, right? So from that, when you know that, you have to have a grassroots program. I think the whole thing, like splitting it, this whole narrative about, oh, you just want to go young or whatever. No, like, there's certain parameters and certain things that go into the equation that push you to that direction, right? Like, if we wanted to have a $100 million tax bill, I would have been really trying to nail find a way to add more money any way we can through trade, through whatever. But once you talk about doing the grassroots and doing that thing, it's just through those conversations I have with people, and how that basketball acumen develops over time and it's constantly growing. Where it's currently at is, like, I just feel like the first portion of the draft is a premium talent portion. And this draft, man, early 30s maybe it runs into. Some drafts, it's only 17, 18, right? And in that first portion's premium, it's about young, talented guys that can play, that were productive, that seem like they're going to for sure be NBA players. And I think the second portion of the draft, and I think a couple of years when I had that job, it was like, it was a little drier. It wasn't this year's class. I think, like, in that second portion, like, why are you there? If you're a one and done and you're there in that portion of the draft, and the whole league decided they didn't want to take you in a premium portion of the draft, like, you're probably hanging by your nails on having a good NBA career. So tickets there because his game's not aesthetically pleasing and he's old, you know, Collins undersized and, not that athletic. Like all those guys are going to have, Deron played at a mid-major school. I think that was probably, and people thought he moved a little weird. But other than that, I thought Deron was probably like the guy that was maybe the most undervalued as far as all those things. So I think it's just, I think it's just
fine. Near 7-footer, shoots threes, yeah, and can switch and all that.
I mean, Spencer Jones one is just like sometimes that's where intel comes into. Robert Eason, a good friend of mine who's the head coach at UIC. I remember I called him from the Cosmo, maybe in the Chandelier Bar, like 2 p.m., just hanging out, waiting to go to the next game. And I asked him about Spencer. And he's like, man, he's the only guy on our team that could guard every guard in the Pac-12. Like 6'9". 225. He shot really well early in his career. He has this wrist thing, I think, that makes that shot look really weird now. I'm like, what are we waiting for? We'd already had experience before when under the old regime where we had a gym, and I won't say who the other player was, but we had Jayshon Tate in that gym, and he killed summer league practice, killed it. But he didn't have a signature game in summer league. So, like, from that experience, I'm like, I think people can place too much value on waiting for somebody to play well in a summer league game, and then they give them a two-way, or they've earned it at that point. But it's so happenstance. So, Spencer was on Portland. Maybe he was sick. Maybe they have too many guys. He doesn't play. So, you're not going to sign him to a two-way because what? Like, randomness? So, that what I heard from Eason, and I watched him film myself, but that was just confirmation. He coached the kid every day. That drives the decision to go ahead and be assertive about getting that guy on a two-way commit. And I'm happy for him. I'm happy for the team. You know, David's done a great job implementing them and using them, and I think he's definitely an NBA player.
You mentioned the word alignment earlier, and that makes me think about the time when you traded Bones Highland and it opened up minutes for Christian Brown. Bones was playing like 20 minutes per game and Brown was at like 12 minutes per game. And then post-trade, Brown's closer to 20 and obviously becomes a fixture in the playoff rotation. Tons of big moments, hustling all around the floor. At that time when that deal happened, can you get into the mindset behind that decision? And also, was there alignment between you and Malone at that time?
I think it was locked up. I think like there's some things that happened behind the scenes that I drove that decision. I'm not going to sit here and say that, like, I pounded the table and made Josh trade. Like, I mean, I think everybody, had ownership in that, even Bones. Like, Bones knew where the team was at with him.
He was benched for the 10 days or so prior, right?
Yeah, I mean, alignment's just like one of these words. I mean, we won a championship. There was definitely alignment, right? Like, I think, like I said, these things grow legs. They're, out of all the things being reported out of Coach Malone and Ma's relationship. Never a physical altercation in front of people. Never a verbal altercation in front of people. So where is the beef, right? Like,
was there a physical altercation behind closed doors?
Hell no.
He said in front of people.
That's what would have been reported, right? That's what would have been reported. Like, so.
I don't like his chances against 6'10", 6'11".
It's not even about that. I mean, like, but like Coach Malone, I mean, here he is, and that's going to be, and hey, look, I guess this is where we both have, maybe we have to take some accountability in it, but like at the end of the day, he doesn't deserve to be working on a table at ESPN commentating games over some perceived rift that like is basically gone on since the annals of time in every professional sport. Like the stakes were higher in Denver, like we were competing for a championship. I think it was blown way out of proportion, honestly.
You really think so?
Yeah, I think it was blown way
out of proportion. I mean, I don't hear stories like that between coach and GM and many other teams. Obviously, there's like friction sometimes. There's different. Like,
what's the story?
Views.
What's the main story? What's the main go-to story?
I mean, I think you could look. Oh, between you guys?
Yeah, what's the main go-to story?
I've heard stories about like you talking to media members, like he's not playing our guys, he's not playing our young guys and stuff like that. Like some annoyance between decisions being made, like the lack of alignment aspect.
So potential gossip?
What was that?
Potential gossip.
Stuff like that.
That's a smoking gun?
No, I just think that's one of the things that comes to mind.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I think that is pretty clear on paper sometimes. He wanted to play vets.
Mm.
you wanted young guys to develop. It was just differing philosophies.
How many teams do you think that's happened with currently?
Oh, it definitely happens. Also, I think it happens with Conley and Finch right now. Yeah. I mean, Dillingham never really got an opportunity there. Like, Leonard Miller never really got an opportunity.
I don't think it's unique to that situation or our situation. I think it happens with every team at some level of the NBA. I tell you what never happened. I believed in letting the coach, and, you know, we let each other do our jobs, man. I think, like, you know, I just think things got blown out of proportion. And I think, like, you know,
there was— Is it fair to say there was tension, though?
I mean, I think there's tension everywhere in that, at that point. You know, like, when the expectation level is what it is, I think, and some of that tension is natural, right? Like, I think sometimes people want to win on their own terms, right? Like, winning sometimes is tension filled. Winning sometimes isn't like kumbaya. Like, you know, everybody sees The Last Dance. They see the things that happen behind the scenes. Like, to win, you have to have friction. Now, how much of it can you have, and where can it go along? And, like, you know, those are different things that people need to fill out and all that kind of stuff.
Were you surprised that they got rid of the both of you?
I don't know. I think the timing of it, probably, if I had to say, probably surprised a lot of people.
You included?
I wasn't anticipating that day.
Do you think Malone wasn't either?
Probably not.
When they told you that they were getting rid of you, did they explain why? Did they tell you that Malone was also going to be going?
I don't know if there needs to be an autopsy on that whole deal, but I will say, like, you know, I think the time was he went first. And one of the things I heard from, you know, the organization was that, you know, and I feel like this hits me hard because, like, they don't want to be a winner or a loser. So when you say a winner or a loser, that's reference to a game. It's not a game to me. It's my life. Like, I'm doing what I think is best for organization, what I think is best for the team. There's no gamemanship in it. It's me being passionate about my job and trying to do the best I can, best we can, to win. So, like, I think I was a little, that one was a little hard to take.
And prior to Kroenke firing you and Malone, did he do anything to mediate the tension in the months or the years prior to that?
Yeah, I don't think there's, again, there doesn't need to be an autopsy on that whole thing.
I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, you seem pretty open about it.
No, I think we've talked enough about it.
Okay. I mean, I think last thing with Malone, when it comes to the youth aspects, developing young players, what were conversations like? What are conversations like between front office and coaching staff about objectives, developing young players? Like, how do those conversations happen?
Well, I mean, the great Flip Saunders used to say, there's idealistic and there's realistic. And I think that's what happens between front office and coaches in general. I think the front office are a lot more idealistic about it. Sometimes I'm saying that, like, in a potentially negative way. And the coaches are dealing with the reality every day. They're feeling – I mean, geez, man, like, the Buffalo coach gets let go because the guy missed a field goal, right? That's their reality. They're thinking any day they can get fired, right? So they're not, like – you know, I was too idealistic thinking that, like, at the time that, like, a coach under that kind of pressure could, like, you know – be open to executing a plan, especially for somebody that didn't have a track record. I was new. Why should you listen to me, right? Like, why shouldn't you just go what most coaches do, just focus and try to do the best we can? And I think this is where sports becomes really interesting to me, because I feel like if you go way back to the annals of time, sports is just a simulation of war, right? And so if you go back and look at the 2022-23 Nuggets, I think we were barely over 500, like, the last 28 games a year. We went through, we won one. We had never played that deep in the playoffs before, right? Guys were going to need to rest. where it was probably going to be a struggle to go into the next season. Like, and to boot, you talk about my study into history, San Antonio Spurs never won back-to-back championships. So in an idealistic way, when we're talking and having conversations, I think there was alignment in these conversations. I think Coach Malone was on board with it. But like when you start the war and it gets realistic and you're feeling like your job or life's on the line, like you alter the plan, right? Like, and I think that's completely fair. I don't think that's unique to anybody that has coached in that. You know, I think every coach would have some element of that. And like that's what we said, that's what the whole league goes through. But I mean, I think that was winning the championship and to me thinking like that, like, okay, how do we get another one? How do we try to win another one? I would have just ventured. And I'm not saying like, I felt like the best way to go about it would have probably been like, oh man, we're in the finals. Let's win it. Like not going to season like, oh, we got to make the finals. We're going to repeat, da 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 da. Like, I feel like we never win the championship in that scenario if we approach it that way. Because I think the one thing that's been, it's almost like the championship isn't real in Denver. They never talk about it. All they do is talk about the next one. I don't think some people without the organization, really realize how hard it is to win. I think it just happened too easily. And I think a lot of people in that community take it for granted.
Was it easy though? I mean, there was playoff losses.
I mean, there wasn't Scottie Pippen. I mean, we had our own kind of adversity, but it was different. Like Jamal missed the year with an ACL, Mike's out with a back. It wasn't Scottie Pippen getting clubbed by Bill Laimbeer and leaving the game with a migraine. And then the next game, like, it wasn't that kind. It was a longer, slower build, and there was some adversity the team went through. But like, for two guys to come back, two of your major players to come back from injury, for there to be a major change in front office, go through the season, win a championship. Like, how often is that going to happen?
Is that and why in part? Like when you and I had our sit down in 2023, it was like about building something sustainable, about building something to win multiple over time. But you did at the time downplay going back to back because of the difficulty in doing that. Was that part of your intentions at the time? Like saying, we want to build something long-term, not just about trying to win it all this year.
Well, and so here's where I said, you know, to complete my last thought, here's where it ties into, like, if it's actually war, right? And we have a campaign and we win this big campaign and then we forge into the next campaign and 60% of the army dies. Like that can happen one time. The next army, whoever the next general is, they're going to study military history, and they're not going to do that. But in sports, every year, oh, go back to back, oh, they should win it, da 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 da. Like, and like, even if the team should not be, and one of our objectives internally, and hey, look, Christian Brown played plenty of minutes when he was there. I think Peyton Watson played a lot of minutes, especially considering like what had happened and what Coach Malone's track record had been for vets. Like, I mean, two guys breaking through, that's about what you can ask. So I think a lot of these things, I mean, if we were to have a sit down with Coach Malone, myself and all these, I think we both admit a lot of stuff is over. He did, like, Christian Brown, Peyton Watson are both going to be making contracts for $20 to $25 million, right? Maybe more for Peyton, who knows? And the guys did play a lot under Coach Malone. So he did develop them. So I just think like, I mean, because the people that get hurt in the whole scenario, I know Coach Malone, he doesn't mind commentating games, but he would probably die to coach an NBA team tomorrow, die to be a head coach tomorrow. And he deserves it. He's a championship coach that, you know, has the most wins in Nuggets history. Like, I mean, hey, look, I become more intrigued by entrepreneurship because like, you know, like there were a number of jobs open. I didn't speak to one owner. I spoke to one secondary ownership group in Atlanta. Didn't get a look at those jobs. And if I looked at it, if I was just open to assistant general manager, director of player personnel, whatever, maybe somebody's eyeing me. I don't know about out there, but like, I'm just saying, my door wasn't knocking down when people were waiting to hire me. And I felt like, again, that's where this whole thing got blown out of proportion if you just look like tangibly what I did, what my win percentage was, what I drafted, working with a coach like Coach Malone as a first-time GM, like, I just don't know how my door isn't, you know?
Well, is there anything that you feel like you learned from that experience that you would go back and change, that if you got another opportunity, you would do differently now?
I mean, you have to move forward. You definitely learn from your past experiences, and there's a lot that I did that you know, I was happy with.
What weren't you happy with, though? Like, what do you regret doing then that you would change now?
I have to take accountability in how that thing grew legs. Whatever way that narrative grew legs and my part in it, I've learned from that. And whatever way alignment
can happen. What is that exactly?
I don't know. But whatever way alignment can happen. Like, alignment is just one of these terms that's thrown out. We were definitely aligned when we won a championship. There's no way you're not winning when you're not aligned. But what is alignment like in the scenario that I talk about with that, when you think about that paradox, just that general paradox about how head coaches, they're the only people in the world that have that kind of authority, that those kind of people listen to, that have to, like, maybe report to some, quote unquote, report to somebody. And that wasn't Coach Malone's relationship. So when I get that title, it's not an option for me not to do my job, right? I'm going to do my job. So I think one of the only outcomes where everybody thinks we're aligned is me submit, lay down, not do the job, and that's not an option for me. So some version of this was when it happened. Could have been quieter, could have not grown legs with the media, could have not been such a crawl in ownership's pants, like, maybe there's some different things that could happen in that regard.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's annoying. If you're an owner of a team and you're hearing about a conflict between, you know, your head coach and your GM, however real or however blown out of proportion it is, like, you know, that's not, they have 7 other sports teams to run, like, right? You know,
the way I look at it, though, Calvin, is it's not often that a GM and a coach get fired on the same day. Mm. Like, was it really blown out of proportion when that just never happens?
I don't know. I have a hard time processing that question. I don't even really know what it means.
I mean, it's obviously like a difficult situation that happened the way it did end up happening. But I think with Malone being now in media, I'd imagine he'll get some interests in another head coaching gig at some point. Do you want a GM again, or are you open to working in a front office if it's not being the lead decision maker?
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate to get this job. It's all you can want to do is be a part of a good group. And I was fortunate that Arturis Karnisovas got the Bulls job. I mean, Tim ended up taking a Minnesota job in a strange scenario. And I got an opportunity to run a team, and I felt like I did a good job of it. It's not, nobody's entitled or owed an opportunity to run an NBA team. There's 30 jobs, there's 30 people sitting right now. All those guys, in their own way, deserve to be in that seat. So, like, I'd be foolish to say, for the right scenario, that I wouldn't be willing to, you know, work for somebody or do whatever. But I am intrigued by, doing my own thing in IL space and consulting with teams, trying to figure out the market, it's a new world in college basketball. They're now professional officially. And I think they have to act as such. And I think they're trying to figure that whole process out. Often a lot of teams have GMs, but with NCAA rules and stuff, there's like restrictions on what they can do as far as going out and scouting games and doing things like that. And a lot of them don't have staff. So I am intrigued by that aspect of things and not being subject to an opinion or whatever, right? Like, because, you know, I felt like in that job that I did with the Nuggets, yeah, like, there's some noise around it and there's the narrative about our conflict. But outside of that, there was also some very, very good tangible results. And one of our main objectives was to have a sustainable window open for Joker, and they're in that position right now.
You mentioned where they are now. They've traded MPJ for Cam Johnson. They bring back Bruce Brown. They sign Jonas Valanciunas and Tim Hardaway. What have you thought about the moves that Denver has made since you were let go?
Oh, they're great. A lot of them we talked about when I was there. I mean, we thought we were going to get Valanciunas at the trade deadline. So they're great. And they're playing. Tim Hardaway's been fantastic.
So it's kind of a continuation of the plan.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they did their own unique things, but like I mean, the one thing about the new CBA, there's only so many trades that can be done, right? It's kind of like paint by numbers in that sense. So anybody that's in that seat in Denver is going to have some kind of Michael Porter Jr. for Cam Johnson concept, because that's just one of the better deals that was out there, right? So I think that's the way it looks.
Do you think the Nuggets still have dynasty potential?
I mean, it doesn't help they had such bad luck with injuries this year. Never know. Like, when I was taking over and knowing that what people have called term two timelines, but what I was seeing at the time when I went to that job, Golden State had just won it. And they had Kuminga, Wiseman, Moody, three lottery picks, laying in wait. Now, come to find out, it just didn't quite work out for whatever reason there. But kind of OKC took their place. Minnesota took their place. So, like, you know, I feel like knowing that, like, Golden State setting that frame for work, for knowing that, like, if Golden State didn't have those three young guys, maybe the way I looked at how we could survive in the West over time looked different. I do think, you know, they have a puncher's chance with Jamal Murray having the best year of his career, Joker's being Joker. I think Aaron Gordon is a complete stud. I mean, it's just going to have how they walk the tightrope with the second apron and all that stuff.
You mentioned Jamal Murray having the best season of his career. He's been unbelievable this year. What were some of the challenges with him in the past where it felt like post-title he was never quite at that level again for the full duration of the season? Was that something you would take into account when you were trying to construct a roster?
It's hard for me to go in that place where I'm thinking about it, but like zooming out where I'm sitting at today, you got to really think about this guy's arc over those years. You miss a year with ACL, you come back and win a championship, right? And I think the next couple of years, you know, getting used to your new knee, trying to find enough rest, like,
you know, get out of shape sometimes.
Yeah, you know, having a kid, like, you know, not being in the kind of condition to perform the way he has consistently like he is right now, right? Like, you can see right now, like, he has energy to go, like, 15 rounds, right? Like, you know, maybe before some of those times, he was, like, not a 15-round guy.
Especially at the start of the seasons.
Yeah.
And I mean, this year has been absolutely unbelievable. And we'll be right back after this break. You mentioned what you're doing now involving with college basketball. Can you describe that a little bit more? Like, what's the lane you kind of see that's missing that you're trying to fill?
Yeah, the lane I see is, you know, consulting teams on how teams at the professional level operate in player personnel and separating. Because you got to remember, in college, a lot of the coach did academics, donorship, coaching strategy, recruiting. Now they're adding another piece of the pie. They're adding, transfer portal. And from what I see, where I see the opportunities at is these guys have to try to manage the portal. And they're, like I said, sometimes they're hiring GMs. But there's 365 Division I teams. There'll be probably approximately 2,000 players enter the portal. Like, how, and if the GM is housed in-house, if he doesn't have an assistant coaching title, he can't go out and scout random live games. So now you're looking.
It's a strange rule.
They're not. No. Assistant coaches are allowed to scout. I believe I'm paraphrasing here, but they're allowed to scout teams they're about to play. Like, and I don't think anybody does that, but maybe the GMs take advantage of that. But so yeah, if the only way you're allowed to scout is if you have assistant coaching title, and if you have assistant coaching title, you're bound by certain restrictions that are there for the assistant. So now you have 2,000 players roughly in the portal, and some of those can help having a feel for the whole market. And we're not even talking about junior college, international, high school, right? Just the Division I, D2, just the Division I market. I just feel like the quality of the decision-making when you have 2 weeks. The portal window is going to be 2 weeks now. And the top 5%, 10% of that market, top 5% of the market is going to make $1 million or more. So you're multi-million dollar decisions with no live scouting within a short window of time. And so I feel like a lot of times what the coaches have done to this point, they've gone after guys they played against, guys they recruited, or guys in their geographic area. But what happens when you miss on that guy or another school's after a guy? That's how these prices get out. They have so many disadvantages in college as compared to we do, but the one big advantage they have is the overall size of the talent pool.
It doesn't make much sense to me that those coaches aren't allowed to scout, or those executives for colleges aren't allowed to scout. Yeah. It feels like over time that's something that, as NIL, like, is, you know, 10 years ago since it launched, rather than just a handful of years, that I'd imagine those changes would be made to better allow scouting for colleges. But it makes sense that that's kind of the angle you would go from a consult. You're consulting for colleges.
Yeah, consulting, because like if I was a scouting service, I had to register as a scout. I'm trying to get overall feel for the market. That's why I've gone to so many games and trying to notice trends and things like that. You know, by the letter of the law, I'm not out there to see AJ DeBanson to go tell somebody to go after him, right? Because that would be a scouting service. I had to register. We're helping on team strategy, team building strategy, how to allocate your money, how to be sustainable over a long period of time. But I do know what the market looks like because I've seen a lot of it.
That said, you mentioned you're not telling anybody go get AJ DeBanson, these obvious players. I am curious your thoughts on the top of this draft with Boozer at Duke, DeBanson at BYU, and then Peterson at Kansas with those three guys. Do you have a preference of those three, a guy that you think belongs in the number one slot, or could it even be somebody else?
Yeah, I just think that top of the draft is really, really talented. Who knows when be the best out of those guys? You know, you saw those guys, you have Caleb Wilson and Wagler and Darius Acuff and Kingston Flemings. And, you know, it's just, I don't know when a draft's been this deep. So I've been more personally like focused on, you know, the whole landscape. So I haven't watched 10 AJ DeBanson games, but I do think, you know, it's one of those drafts where maybe a team's hoping they get the pressure taken off of them by getting the second or third pick, right? Like, I think it's going to be a really tough decision.
Have you ever seen so much tanking in the NBA?
I know. It's the NBA's coming aggressively, and they tried to curb it, and I think it's going to be good for the product.
Is there a rule change you'd have in mind to curb tanking?
I kind of thought, and I don't know how this could be with the players, because I was a player before. It was sucked for some of the veterans, but I kind of thought, like, if you were, like, the play-in team or whatever, because I think there is value in playing in the playoffs, right? So it all depends on where you're at in your development arc. Like Charlotte, especially in the average draft, they may want to play in the playoffs because, you know, they had LaMelo for a while. But what if they had an option to opt out and they get the top two pick, top three pick? So you're pushing to make the 10th seed or the play-in. At that point in time, you get an option. I mean, and I guess you'd have to go all the way up to seven, right? Because teams to seven team gets, maybe you only do it with one team in each conference. The seven-seeded team gets to decide whether they want to compete in the playoffs and play or whether they want the number one pick, you know? I think that's how you get the most pure competition. Again, it would suck for the veterans, and, you know, you're missing out on playoff bonus. There's all kind of stuff with the players' union that probably makes that idea too idealistic, you know?
I mean, in that scenario, I still worry you would see a team drop from six to seven, right? Well, you know what? we would rather have the odds, and you could tank out of the sixth spot. But I do like the idea. I think incentivizing winning, to me, is the key thing. And if you can, whether it's the wheel or whatever the philosophy is that you have when it comes to revising the draft, I always think about the top of the standings. Like, in the NBA right now, there's incentive to get the 7 or 8. You only have to win one play-in game instead of two as a 9 or 10. There's incentive to get the 5 or 6. You're locked in. You're guaranteed a spot. And then there's incentive to get a top 4 seed because you get home court in the first round, or if you're the 1 seed, you get home court throughout the entire postseason and your conference. But how often do we see teams lose a game to get the 3 seed instead of the 2 seed because they prefer that seeding? You're still incentivized to lose in some scenarios. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would love to see the NBA allow the one seed to choose their playoff opponent from that's the five idea. To eights. Yeah, and then idea. The second seed gets the second choice. The third seed gets the third choice. And then the fourth seed gets the leftover. Yeah, that way the idea. Incentive is even stronger at the top of the league, because everybody's focused on the bottom right now. But I think incentives are going to matter still at the top of the league too. And we know the NBA has interest in that. They tried it with the G League, or yeah, when it was yeah, the D League yeah. years ago, yeah. they tried like something like that. How would those conversations go in a front office? Do you think the front office would be a fan of that or no?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some teams and organizations spend a lot more time getting in the weeds with the strategy and stuff. I'd be very interested to be in some of those places. Like I'd love to be a fly on the wall and see what Sam Presti thought about, you know, what his thoughts were on this stuff, right? Like, because he's very intentional about all this different stuff. So I like, it intrigues me. If we came up, I'd definitely spend time on it. But like, I think like, you know, to have that level of granular focus on it, like when there's nothing, it's not something I'd probably be capable of doing if I was in the job, you know?
You mentioned Sam Presti. What makes Sam Presti so successful as a general manager?
Attention to detail. It's just very professional. I think he has a vision. You know, it's funny. I don't know if I ever mentioned this to Sam. I did talk to Russ about this, but like when I started, you know, I was still playing. The first draft I did was like the 2008 draft. And I love Russell Westbrook. And I was just like, why is he at the, you know, lower end of the lottery and a lot of these mock drafts and stuff like that? And, you know, I think one of those places, I think that was modified and he was moved to the top, but we won't discuss that. You know, but anyway, Sam takes him fourth. Nobody had him going fourth, right? And I've always like, you know, since that moment, I've always kind of admired him. I've kind of like meant, like if just one person outside of somebody that I've worked for that I look at is Sam. I think he's done two rebuilds, right? And he's finally finishing to win it. I think, you know, obviously they have complete, you know, lockstep, you know, because he's been there for so long. In sync with ownership, in sync with Dagnall. They have such a, they're so regimented in how they execute everything.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, like when you were talking about alignment earlier, like in the back of my mind, I was thinking about OKC with Dagnall. Dagnall, last year, there was a time with Hartenstein coming back from injury and Chet coming back from injury where they were playing the two bigs together. And Dagnall had a big media scrum where they were asking like, hey, this the two big lineup's not working too well. And Dagnall had a long, elaborate answer about the importance of experimentation during the season and putting that those lineups into situations where maybe it doesn't make sense to use them together. But he needs that lineup to get experience in situations that don't always work. And you see the way the OKC Thunder integrate young guys and develop young guys while also playing their key rotation guys and all that. It's like an amazing operation to the alignment that they have from top to bottom in that organization.
Yeah.
Does that all come from the GM, from Sam Presti, and creating that culture? Or how did they create that? It's amazing to me.
Yeah. I just had to stop what you're talking about. I mean, it's just all about the trust, right? Like, you know, and a lot of coaches, rightfully so, don't have that trust. Like, I mean, in my position while I was operating a job, I had full trust that I had support and, you know, back and maybe I was wrong about that, you know? And like, I think that's what the head coach experience is. Can I trust that when I do this, I'm going to keep my job, right? And I think over his time there and how consistent he is and what he's developed, there's that trust where the head coach knows that, like, if I execute this plan that we have, that we're going to focus on the process and not the outcomes. And like, that's a beautiful situation to have. I mean, forget about basketball. That's so hard to get to in football, baseball, even in college. Like, so they just have a really, really unique situation. And I mean, head coaching, I don't envy those guys. It's a miserable job most of the time.
It's always your fault if things don't go well if you're exactly. a coach, right?
Yeah.
What is there an overrated trait that you think GMs look for too much?
I think there's, in my experience the last few years, there's a lot of just safety in numbers type decision making, right? Like, did you really want to take that guy at said pick? Or is that what the consensus of the league and the podcast and the mock draft said? And, you know, you have to draft the guy in that spot.
This is the old Wesley Johnson over Paul George thing when Minnesota had executives that wanted Paul George, sure. But ownership was like, no, Paul George is going in the late lottery. We can't take him with the fourth pick.
Yeah, sure. Something like that. Yeah, to that effect. So I think, like, the more, you know, people are like, that's what another thing I can appreciate about Sam and the San Antonio Tree guys and even the Miamis and some of these other places that they have their own individual identity. They don't care what other people think about the decisions they make. If they feel like, you know, in Miami's case, having this E10 work all the way up to the starting position and even paying that guy is the right thing, that's what they'll do. I just don't think a lot of NBA teams operate like that.
Do you think that'll change now that Jonathan Givony is gone from the media? He's working only privately. He was the anchor. It felt like Givony had the board and the mocks that everybody would reference with where these guys are going to go, and rightfully so. Givony's brilliant at what he does. But now that he's gone from the media sphere, do you think that will change when it comes to front offices kind of thinking, well, nobody actually knows where anybody's going to go because that's not a factor anymore?
No, I think there's some great people out there filling the space.
I'm not just talking to myself for Sam Vecenie or everybody else, but I think
it's the collective of the collective of the lower level scouts when they're on the road and who they're talking to, what they look at. I don't think it's like, oh yeah, it's Jonathan Givony and he's like running everything. I think it's like, it's a collaborative effort with all the junior scouts that are on the road and, you know, what's said on X? Like, is it going to be a popular pick? What's going to be said on Instagram with Mox? It's a aggregation of all those things, right? Like, I think if somebody is making their own unique decisions, I respect that so much because it is easy to just go get the A draft grade on day one and ride that out.
Does the date January 13th, 2004 mean anything to you?
No.
That's the date you had 10 blocks in 17 minutes, including 4 blocks on LeBron James.
Yeah. I think you brought this up earlier. I thought about that game. I think that was just out of survival desperation. I think I was playing against Jadrenis Ogauskas, who
had
a significant size advantage and, you know, probably 3 blocks, probably 8 offensive rebounds given up. So I think I'm still in the negative on that one, but, you know.
You guys did lose the game. 4 blocks on rookie LeBron, though.
Yeah. No, that's it. It wasn't like a game, oh, that was my best game of my NBA career. Like, it wasn't like that.
I mean, it's a fascinating game. 10 blocks in 17 minutes is pretty outrageous.
Yeah.
What do you remember from that game? Why were you so successful in blocking shots?
Yeah, well, if you give up offensive rebound, the next thing is you got to block a shot, right?
I tried to find find video of the game. I couldn't find it on YouTube or anything like that.
No, I think you can have a lot of fine games where I change the game way more in different kind of ways. It's more impactful to the team, but. Had a little gimmick stack that people like to bring up because I didn't score in that game, I believe. Like, yes, that's nothing.
Who's the best locker room guy you've ever been around, whether you were playing or as an executive?
There's so many different options, man. And it just depends on. But I do have to say, I feel like the last couple of years, I mean, Jeff Green's one of the better ones. I feel like he passed the torch to DeAndre Jordan. I thought he was fantastic. Our locker room. I do think Russell Westbrook gets a really bad rap. He's that dude, the way he approaches every day when he comes in. He was in the gym every night working, setting an example. Like, I really, really respect his. But I think the guy that the consensus from the league, here's what I'll do my group think, because I've never been around him. I think if you ask this question to a number of NBA guys, is there so many people would say Derrick Rose.
Interesting. Yeah. Derrick Rose is the best locker room guys.
Yeah, like, beloved by every teammate he's played with. You know, so I think it's just a combination of his humility and his talent and how his presence, but like, I mean, he's probably the model for, I think to get that title, you probably have to have been like a top pick and then like have had every role in the NBA, right? Like kind of like Derek has had.
You mentioned Russ, like the bad rep he has. I think with Russ, there's like no doubt about what he is as a teammate. I think with Russ, it's always just been about some of the on-court decision-making, particularly in end-game situations. Mm. And I think that plays into the rep people talk about with him.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, I mean, Russell Westbrook, when you say his name, it's just, for some reason or another, it's polarized. And I think if I'm Russ, I think it should just be more positive, right? Because I have all these records. I've had a fantastic career. And like, I know what I do every day on an everyday basis when I go into the locker room, and I know how people, the players, what I'm doing for the players and how to respect me. So I just think from that perspective, I just think it's interesting. That's why I say Russ.
Totally. I mean, I think with Russ, it's totally fair to say. I mean, game-wise, I've always had my questions with him in endgame situations. Like, I even wish with OKC sometimes he would defer to KD more. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Who do you think is the most underrated player in the NBA right now?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think about who the top players in the NBA are right now. I feel like all these young guys get their due. I'm gonna be a homer. I'm gonna go with Peyton Watson. Yeah,
it's a good homer pick. But yeah. Why is he underrated? Do you think?
I just think because his path to where he is today has been so unique, right? You know,
3 points per game in college, right?
Yeah, and even his route in the NBA, like the role and the minutes have fluctuated and all that kind of stuff, and he's had this moment. I think he's starting to get the attention that he deserved, but I do think he has been.
Does he have all NBA upside?
I mean, I played with like Gilbert, and I feel like I know there's guys in between, but like for these guys that are drafted in a late first, second round, is he one of the most coveted, you know, restricted free agents since like Gilbert? Like, I mean, Otto Porter was a higher pick. He went to the Nets. Jimmy Butler ended up signing. Gordon Hayward got matched, and he was a high lottery pick. I'm just thinking, but I think, I mean, Jokic, obviously, but Jokic had a weird deal where it was a team option he opted in. So, I mean, I think, like, from the fact that he's going to be a restricted free agent and what he's shown in this last 8 weeks or whatever, and at his age is, I believe, 23, I don't like talking about ceilings. My whole thing with players is get a good player and you don't know where that ceiling is. It one of the things that drives me, I can't say nuts. Nuts is too strong. It doesn't drive me nuts, but it's slightly annoying. It's like how everybody constantly tries to place a ceiling on different guys like Christian Brown. Oh, he's only going to be this. Like, you don't know. Like, what's his work ethic? What's his opportunity? Like, when Jimmy Butler goes 30, does anybody know he's going to be Jimmy Butler? Or Fred Van Fleet's undrafted. Does anybody know he's going to be Fred Van Fleet? So I just think you try to get a player you think is going to be good and you just see what happens, right? Like, I don't think you're ever going to know what somebody's true ceiling is, right?
Like, so with Peyton Watson, like when you take him 30th, you aggressively traded to go get him. Like, your mindset at the time is this guy's long. We think he can be a 3-and-D guy at worst. And who knows? Maybe much more than that.
Yeah, I think part of that, I think with Peyton is just, I've said this before, but it kind of reminded me. I played with Iguodala, and I had a dinner with Peyton. His basketball recall was incredible. Even if you asked him, how would you guard somebody who was in the NBA like Luka at the time, he could tell you exactly what to do. Now, could he execute that at the time? No, right? But he knew exactly what to do. So somebody that has that kind of smarts to go with that kind of athleticism and good instincts. And the story made sense, man. Like, how in with this? Like, basically, he's a McDonald's All-American. He goes to UCLA. They make the Final Four. Everybody comes back. They have Jules Bernard, Hawkes, Johnny Juzang. The other part of the scenario, in the G League, like, and I think it's a cautionary tale for a lot of NBA executives and stuff, you can pull out tape in the G League where he's doing some versions of what he's been doing lately. But, like, I know a lot of people in and around the league thought that wasn't real when it was happening, right? You know? So I think he had the McDonald's, he had the UCLA reason why he didn't play, he did play well in the G League. There's a lot of reasons to believe that this wasn't a fluke. And when he was younger, I would tell him something. It's like, you ruined like 1,000 basketball players. Because nobody should enter the draft with the average 3 points, but you're going to make it work.
One of the things I always love about the draft is just how everybody's trajectory and development is so dramatically different. Some guys rise fast and then they plateau and it's not for many years that they figure it out. Some guys, they start late, they're late bloomers. They don't figure it out until their junior, senior seasons. And I was looking, your son's having his breakout year. He's a junior now. I remember you and I talked about him when he was entering his freshman year, and you said he's like a Rashard Lewis type, much different than me as a player. I remember you saying he's shooting over 40% from three this year at 6'10". What's clicked for your son this year at Colorado State?
It's about opportunity and belief, you know. Ali's done a fantastic job with him, Coach Furkamesh at Colorado State. And, you know, Carrie's just, I mean, when you put the work in, what I've been told by the great workers and people to do this, put the work in, it'll eventually pay us off. And, you know, Carrie, he lives in the gym, he stays in the gym. So hopefully he continues to play and get better, and he has a shot of playing in the NBA one day.
I mean, 6'10", 40% shooter, and I think it's cool. Like the Colorado State, the Nick Clifford, David Roddy type of opportunity, how those guys developed as upperclassmen. Was that part of the appeal for him to go there?
Yeah, I love the offense. Coach Nico ran when he was there. I know Ali was going to run a lot of the same stuff, like Princeton offense. They teach you basketball. You play all over the floor. You're not relegated to just one thing, because I think one of the issues early in Carrie's career was just his three-point rate was just way too high. Like, you're too young to have like a 70% three-point rate, you know.
Well, Calvin, I very much appreciate you coming on today. I love this conversation. I know we've had our beef in the past, but we've always loved talking basketball together. I know, absolutely. And thank you for coming on.
All right. Appreciate you having me.